Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, November 16th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk with Deputy Lands Manager Dan Blydorn and Rachel Friedlander about the CBJ Air Quality Monitoring Program. We'll talk with Michelle Hayworth about the Alaska Design Forum's Future Tense Program. Andrew Bogar from the Red Cross will be here to talk about keeping your home safe for the holidays. And Crystal Randolph from UAS's Tidal Echoes will be here with news about the upcoming issue. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Currently 34 degrees at the Juno Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation has declared water from the San Juan River safe for livestock. Restrictions were put in place for farmers and ranchers after the August Gold King Mine waste spill. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
The Navajo Nation Environmental Protection Agency says samples from the San Juan River show levels of mine waste toxins have declined. The Gallup Independent reports the agency recommended President Begay allow ranchers to again use the water after access was suspended more than 3 months ago. Tests conducted soon after the spill showed heavy metal content in the river that exceeded safe amounts for humans and livestock. In August, U.S. EPA and contract workers triggered the 3 million gallon mine waste spill, which tainted the Animas and San Juan Rivers. Following the incident, farmers in the Navajo Nation's Shiprock chapter voted to keep irrigation canals closed for at least a year to protect against soil contamination. The U.S. EPA says its own water tests show the San Juan River has returned to pre-spill conditions, but officials say they'll continue to monitor areas affected by the spill. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A statewide tour of congressional medals awarded to Native American code talkers and their tribes ended in South Dakota last week. Jim Kent has more.
Members of 33 Native American tribes served as code talkers for the U.S. military in World War II and in World War I. Army Master Sergeant Jim Badwound says representatives from 8 tribes among the Osheti Shakawin, or Great Sioux Nation, were among them.
The Army used the Lakota code talkers. They just basically said, hey, can you speak your language? Do you know of anybody else? Can you speak your language? And we're going to make radio men.
The 67 code talkers from South Dakota tribes included Clarence Wolfguts, Simon Brokenleg, Charles Whitepipe Sr., and Anthony Omaha Boy. Code talker family members took part in an honoring ceremony for their relatives at Crazy Horse Mountain on Veterans Day. Each family was given a set of dog tags with their code talker's name, tribal affiliation, and the conflict that they served in. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Two Manitoba First Nations men are demanding an investigation by the Canadian government after they recently received some shocking news. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the two men were switched at birth 40 years ago and were raised by each other's families.
Luke Monius and Norman Barkman, good friends, were born on the same day to families from Garden Hill. It's a fly-in community about 250 miles northeast of Winnipeg. And growing up, they were often told they looked more like the other boy's family. Last summer, the two men agreed that they needed to know once and for all, so DNA tests would be done. Those tests show that they were given to the wrong families after their mothers gave birth. Now Monius and Barkman want to know what happened.
I want the federal government to do an investigation. Why and how this happened to us. I would like some answers for me and my family.
I just want to know, like, what happened 40 years ago. Like, it's hard.
Manitoba's Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, Eric Robinson, held a news conference in Winnipeg. Robinson said the mix-up has affected many people in Garden Hill. Parents, siblings, and other relatives are now learning that what they believed was true is, in fact, not.
The mental, physical, and spiritual well-being of both men has been deeply affected by the loss of their proper identity.
The two men want the Canadian government to investigate the events surrounding the mix-up. In Ottawa, the health minister says she's concerned about the switch and has asked officials in her department to look into the matter immediately and also to reach out to the families involved. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Indigenous Governance Programs at the University of Arizona, educating practitioners and policymakers to implement nation building at home and create stronger Native nations. Course offerings at igp.arizona.edu.
Support provided by Shoshone Bannock Tribal Farms, proud producer of free-range, sustainable buffalo jerky. Holiday delivery of original, peppered, and teriyaki buffalo jerky available on orders placed by December 15th. More information at sbtribalfarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 16th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. I've been joined now in the studio by Rachel Friedlander. She's the Lands and Resources Specialist with the CBJ. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thanks, Scott.
And also Dan Blydorn. He is the Deputy Lands Manager for CBJ. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, nice to have you, too. So we're getting to that time of year when we have to start thinking about air quality a bit. Give us a brief overview of what we should be concerned about and what we should know.
Sure. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the opportunity to be here as well. Mm-hmm. It's really great to be able to come on here and talk about this program. Public participation has been really what's made the program so successful. So opportunities like this where we can inform the public really make it be that much more efficient. So the city monitors the concentration of fine particulate matter in the air and with the goal of keeping the concentrations at a healthy level. The program is part of the Clean Air Act as well. So, and pretty much when weather conditions such as air inversions, they cause the air to be stagnant, and these particulates from wood smoke burning primarily, well, they build up, and they can cause serious respiratory issues, not just with people with asthma, but also young children and seniors as well. So we monitor the concentration, and once they reach an unhealthy level or they're predicted to reach that level, we call an air emergency, which prohibits people from using the wood-burning stoves, with the exception of pellet stoves.
Okay. How many monitoring stations do you have in the valley, give or take?
We have one monitoring station, and it's located on the roof of Floyd Dryden.
Oh, okay. All right. And what, I guess in layperson's terms, what is that minimum amount? When does it start to be unhealthy?
Well, current regulations are at, and it's kind of an interesting unit, it's 35 micrograms per cubic meter. So that's a concentration in a big cube of air. And once the concentrations are above that, we're in exceedance of the Clean Air Act. So if they go above that, we're not abiding by the clean air standards. So our goal is to keep them below that.
Okay.
And what Dan was telling me is that in the valley, of course, it'll look smoky. You'll see almost like a blanket of smoke above you. And depending on how thick it is, you know, you'll really be able to see it. And then the smell is how you can also tell that an air emergency could be on the horizon. Not to make a pun there.
And the valley is especially susceptible because of the mountains on the sides, right, and the glacier and just the inability of wind to clear it out from time to time?
Yeah, that's correct. In Juneau, our only area of concern is the Mendenhall Valley when it comes to wood smoke air emergencies, and that is correct. It's primarily because of the mountains and the glacier kind of cut off air circulation. We have cold, still air that doesn't get cleared out with using natural forces such as wind. So when we have an air emergency in place, usually there's an inversion as well. And so we're working with NOAA in the valley there off of Back Loop Road and to kind of predict the future weather for the next few days. And we use that information to kind of monitor the air as well. So if we see an inversion in place and we're working with them and they say it's going to last a few days, we can usually call an air emergency with the fact knowing it's going to be at the unhealthy level.
And you're saying that these levels and sort of this initiative probably started back in the 80s, but your current rules are sort of started in 2006. Can you tell us more about that, you two?
Well, it was more a tidbit looking back in the files. There in the valley used to be a group called the Good Air Supply Party, and they were started because they were concerned how the air quality was impacting their children's health. Because the reason why we want clean, healthy air is that these fine particulate matters that your wood is putting into the air as you light up your stove to keep warm. What they do is they are so small they can lodge into your lungs. And so for people with asthma, like Dan was saying earlier, it's harmful, but not just for people with asthma, it's for all of us. So we've been working with the community very successfully to make sure that Juneau's air is clean and healthy.
Okay. So thinking about different kinds of wood burning, there's sort of raw wood that a lot of people like to burn, and then there are also pellets. Is there a difference and a difference in how they're regulated?
There is, yeah. Pellets are a lot cleaner burning, and a lot of times they're regulated when they're processed and made. So those burn efficiently in the sense that wood you can't really monitor. It could be brand new wood. It could be wood that's unseasoned or green. So that's why we monitor just wood burning, because pellets theoretically have a cleaner burning emissions.
And if somebody's house is primarily heated by, say, wood pellets, then they're, of course, still able to burn.
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Pellets are not part of the – when we call an air emergency, you can still use pellet stoves.
Oh, okay, so just wood. Mm-hmm. I see. How do you inform the public?
Well, that's a great question. We have many ways to inform the public. One of my favorites is our wood smoke hotline, and that's 586-5333. And we have an automated message on that machine there. So you'll call it, and it will just be a message, and it will say, we have an air emergency in place or we do not. So it's really fast.
Also, when you're driving through the valley, we have 11 bright neon yellow signs that will say air emergency. And so when those signs are open and you see the neon yellow, you know, okay, I am not going to go light my stove, or I'm going to put it out. Because in addition to just being a good steward of the air, we also want to make sure that people aren't lighting their stoves unintentionally, because we have the police, Juneau Police Department, coming around. And if they see that your stove is lit when there's an air emergency in place, you could potentially get a fine. And that's the last thing we want, because if anything, we just want everyone to have nice, healthy, clean air.
Yeah. And how about the boundaries?
Well, there's other ways that people can find out about air emergencies as well that I just want to mention really quickly. So if you go to Juneau.org, the city's webpage, under Hot Topics, there's Mendenhall Valley Air Quality Program. And if you click that link, it'll open up a page that shows you if there is or is not an air emergency in place. It's just a red banner or a green banner. Really easy, something you can save on your browser and open up every time you want to light the stove. And the final way we inform the public is through radio advertisements. So when we call an air emergency, we actually have on the radio public service announcements that play and tell people that there is an air emergency, and then they'll play again once we cancel it. So that way people will know if they catch it on their way home or if they're listening to the radio at work. The boundaries are pretty straightforward. They're essentially the Mendenhall Valley. So it's to the airport, east along Montana Creek, and includes the east half of the Mendenhall Peninsula, all the way to Fred Meyer. So it's kind of in that area there. Pretty much if you drew a big square around the valley, that would be the air quality monitoring area.
And including there around the airport?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
All the way to the east half of the Mendenhall Peninsula on that side. So.
Okay. So you have the hotline, 586-5333.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody just wanted info or to talk to you, to talk to one of you too, who should they call?
They can call any of us who work for the Division of Lands. Our main number is 586-5252, and you can select Greg, myself, or Rachel here, and any of us can answer questions. And please, public, call us if you have questions. We'd love to talk about this program, and we want to make sure everybody's informed.
Okay. Well, it's kind of cold outside and not very windy. We wonder.
We've been keeping an eye on it.
Yeah, we've been keeping an eye on it every hour.
It looks really good right now. Whenever there's snow or rain, usually that does a great job at cleaning out the air. So it gets a little tricky when it's snowing or raining outside. Usually that's the end or the beginning of an air emergency. A lot of times when we see that rain or that snow in the forecast, it's good news for air quality.
All right. Anything else either of you would like to add?
We just have one tidbit, too, that there's no open burning allowed in Lemon Creek from the same time period. So our air quality monitoring program that goes from October 1st until April 30th of 2016. And so every year, October 1st to April 30th, our Valley residents can expect to have us monitoring their air for good health.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Lemon Creek is involved, too?
Yes, there's no open burning
in Lemon Creek. Okay. Got it. Well, thank you both for coming on the show. Dan Blydorn, he's the Deputy Lands Manager, and Rachel Friedlander, she is the Lands and Resources Specialist at CBJ. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks Scott.
Thanks, Juneau.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 16th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 18 minutes after the hour. And joining me now by phone is Michelle Hayworth. She is the program director for the Alaska Design Forum. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, nice to have you. So the Alaska Design Forum, you guys are a nonprofit. Tell us more about what you're all about.
So the Alaska Design Forum, we're a nonprofit arts agency. We were formed by a group of artists, architects, and designers to broaden the discussion of design in the built environment in Alaska. We've been around since 1992. We have a lecture series that we do every year. We bring up 6 to 8 artists, architects, and designers to lecture in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And then we run some other programs throughout the year.
Okay. And I see that this season is called Future Tense, the 15-16 lecture season. Thinking of that and maybe some past forums or lectures, can you give us an example of what somebody might talk about?
Sure. Well, like I said, it's artists, architects, and designers that we bring up. And they generally lecture on their work. We have a theme that we structure the season around. And so Future Tense this year is about, imagining futures as an important part of what designers do in, designing the built environment. So, for instance, our first lecture this year was Johanna Herm from 546-7896 Architecture in Winnipeg, Canada. And they spoke about some of the projects that they have going on and kind of brought it into a broader discussion about how important design is for our culture, and especially in cities like ours in Alaska, small cities that that need good design.
Mm-hmm. And personally, your background is in sculpture, is that right?
Yes, yes. I have an MFA from Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. I got my undergraduate degree here in Anchorage, Alaska. And, yeah, ended up back in Alaska.
And thinking of Future Tense, I think public art is a good thing, and we probably need more sculptures, right?
Absolutely.
When is your next lecture?
So our next lecture will be Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Anchorage on the 7th of December, Fairbanks on the 8th of December, and then in Juneau on the 9th.
And will that be at the Gold Town this time?
Yes.
Because the last lecture that you just spoke of was downstairs at 360 and was broadcast. I saw that. That was nice.
Yeah, that was our first attempt at, professionally recording and broadcasting a lecture, and it was a very positive experience. Okay. We'll probably do it again, but I hear that everybody really likes the Gold Town.
Oh yeah,
as well.
It's a great art house, cozy theater. It's a really fun place to go. Absolutely. And I'm sorry, did you already mention the title of your next lecture on the 9th?
Oh, sorry. It is Alvin Huang from Synthesis Design and Architecture in Los Angeles.
Okay. Okay. And you said there's usually about 6 of them a year. Is that right?
6 to 8.
Okay. And what can folks expect from Alvin, would you say?
Well, he fits in well with our theme of Future Tense. If you go to his website, synthesis-DNA, DNA like chromosomes, you can see some of his work spans everything from lighting to housewares to large-scale architecture. All of it is very futuristic. There's, I was recently looking on there. There was a 3D printed rocking chair that you could move around in different ways, kind of this ovoid-shaped, beautiful chair.
Okay. If somebody wanted to get more involved with the Alaska Design Forum, how could they do that? Where should they go?
You can go to alaskadesignforum.org, And coming up, we have a design challenge that goes along with our Future Tense lecture series called Future Tense, T-E-N-T-S. So it's a call to the community to design tents, and we'll have a workshop and a lecture coming up in December in Anchorage, and then there'll be a jury to choose the designs, and then three winning designs will actually be fabricated and exhibited at the Anchorage Museum in the fall of 2016.
Interesting. So basically a tent-making contest.
Yes. Yes.
When is the deadline going to be for that?
Registration is open until December 11th, and you can find all of that information on our website, again, alaskadesignforum.org. And then the designs will be due the end of February.
I'm sure we can get more information on this later, but are these tents going to be judged on function, on form? How would you describe that?
Well, it's funny. Last year we had a design challenge. It was a cabin design challenge, and we like to leave these things very open because, you know, you get very poetic responses when you do that. But of course, a lot of people said, no, we want more rules. so, you know, it will be, judged on the aesthetics and the function, and also, with the idea of, can this thing be fabricated and then exhibited at the museum?
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, we're really excited. Last year was we had a really good turnout from all sectors of the community, and very excited to see what people come up with this year for tent design.
Okay, if they want more information, alaskadesignforum.org, is that right?
Yes.
And then also coming up on December 9th is Alvin Huang's lecture, Synthesis, Design, and Architecture at the Gold Town. Is that right, too?
Yes.
All right. Anything else you want to add, Michelle?
I think that's it. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Scott.
Yeah, anytime. Take care.
Okay, you too.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 16th of November, 2015. It's the birthday of the author Chinua Achebe, born in Ogidi, Nigeria, in 1930. His parents were evangelical Protestants, and when he went to university, he gave up his birth name, Albert, and he took his Igbo middle name, Chinua. He joined the Nigerian Broadcasting Service when he was 24 years old, and it was then he wrote his first novel, Things Fall Apart, which is still today the most widely read book of African literature. Achebe describes himself as a cultural nationalist, but nevertheless he writes his books in English, which he's been criticized for. He said that colonialism, for all of its evils, at least gives diverse communities a language with which to talk to one another, and therefore they can reach people all across Nigeria, all the different small language groups. It's the birthday of Andrea Barrett, born in Boston in 1954, went to Union College, got a degree in biology, and she set out to write stories and novels reflecting her interest in science. Her collection of short stories, Ship Fever, became a bestseller in 1996. Because so many of her books deal with science, she has to do research before she writes. In order to finish her novel, The Voyage of the Narwhal, about British scientists exploring the Arctic, Barrett traveled herself to the Arctic. Andrea Barrett, who said, "I think science and writing are utterly the same thing. They're completely rooted in passion and desire, if they're any good at all." And it's the birthday of the man who said, "Satire is what closes on Saturday night." George S. Kaufman, born in Pittsburgh, 1889. He was a drama critic for the New York Times, who went to work as a script doctor polishing up a melodrama, 1918 play called Someone in the House. The play was a flop, but it established Kaufman's reputation as a collaborator, and he set out to collaborate with the playwright Mark Connelly and then Moss Hart, with whom he wrote a smash hit, You Can't Take It With You. 1936, they wrote it in just 5 weeks, start to finish. The story of the Sycamore family spend their time doing ballet, feeding their snakes, playing the xylophone, and making fireworks in the basement. Here's a poem for today, a poem from the early 1600s, Ben Jonson's Song to Celia. Drink to me only with thine eyes, and I will pledge with mine, or leave a kiss but in the cup, and I'll not look for wine. The thirst that from the soul doth rise doth ask a drink divine, but might I of Jove's nectar sup, I would not change for thine. I sent thee late a rosy wreath, not so much honoring thee as giving it a hope that there it could not withered be, but thou thereon didst only breathe and sensed it back to me, since when it grows and smells, I swear, not of itself, but thee. Song to Celia by Ben Jonson. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games, Lumosity.com, and by Staples, with technology products, copy and print shipping, and other solutions for businesses of any size. Learn more at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 16th, 2015, 30 minutes after the hour. Scott Burton, your host. Joining me now on the show is Andrew Bogar. He's the disaster program specialist for the Red Cross here in Alaska and in Juno specifically. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your presence in Alaska here and where your region covers.
So my region covers Yakutak South, and I will admit that I'm relatively new to the Southeast community. I just transplanted down here from Fairbanks, from the office there. For a point of reference, is the mudslide in Sitka was the second day in the office for me. So I hadn't unpacked yet, just grabbed my backpack, got in the plane, went down there. We helped out with that community. And I've been here for a very short time, but I love it here. And we cover Yakutak all the way down south, and primarily we do disasters, respond to disasters here.
Okay. And what we're here to talk about today is how to prevent home disasters. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I'd like to talk about or bring to attention is home fires, and really cover that. And with winter coming on, especially with the holiday period, we'll see an uptick in fires. And we'd like to prevent that by having a discussion about making sure you have smoke detectors. And if you don't, please let us know. We can talk about that in a little while. We have a program that actually will, for free, will install smoke detectors in people's homes. And then just, everyday, maintenance and preparedness things you can do around the house. And the best way of responding to a disaster is just not having it in the first place. And we consider home fires to be a disaster. It's a disaster for that family when they're sitting there watching that house burn.
Absolutely, absolutely. So do you want to start with smoke detectors?
Yeah, we can start with that. That'd be awesome.
Okay. And I don't know if this is too technical of a question. I know that there are two kinds of smoke detectors. There's one that are sort of a standalone, takes a 9-volt battery. You can get them anywhere. And then I know that there are some that are connected throughout the house by wires. Which do you recommend?
Well, I recommend just having one. So okay. I'd rather have one, and regardless of the type, we're seeing more being installed directly into the home and being hardwired in. And then they'll have a backup battery on them. We actually, the free ones that we'll hand out through the home fire prevention campaign actually have a 10-year battery in them. And so it comes with a little plastic bracket that gets drilled straight into the ceiling, and then the smoke detector itself will get exchanged out, and a whole new unit gets put back in.
Okay. And so, and you're saying that as the general public, we're getting better about the actual batteries, but these smoke detectors do have, you know, a life. How long is that, give or take?
Give or take about 10 years. It depends on actually when it was made. So a lot of homes that were built in the early 90s, smoke detectors weren't as good. The technology wasn't as great. So they may have seven to 6 years in them. But without being, you know, an individual who makes them, you know, I do know that the technology in there will degrade after a period of time. And like, you're absolutely correct. We've gotten really good at, we recommend, you know, do it on your birthday or do it for daylight savings times, when you change the clocks, also change your batteries. It's a good way of remembering that. People have gotten pretty good in that. But changing out those smoke detectors, that needs to happen as well.
Okay, and you mentioned a program where people can actually come to you for help with that. How does one do that?
So you can contact me at the Red Cross, and I'll actually pull out my office number here at 907-463-5713. And then also we're also looking for organizations within the community that would be interested in volunteering their time. And we'll actually go out with partnered organizations, and we'll do like install days. And we make a big event out of it, and we'd love to find some partners and volunteer to do that.
Okay. What else should we be worried about, Andrew, or looking out for as we go into the cold season?
So also, when it comes to house fires, the other thing is wood stoves and making sure that you have them cleaned. Wood stoves, so wood-burning stoves, also the wood pellets, anything that you're putting fire into your house, that all the mechanics that go into that, making sure that they're clean, they're well maintained prior to starting it up. Coming from the interior, I'm very used to seeing an uptick in home fires when it comes to wood burning stoves, and it's just being aware of that, making sure before you use them, you're keeping your family safe.
Okay, and it's pretty soon. A lot of folks are probably going to be getting Christmas trees. Is that something to watch out for?
Yes. Christmas trees have traditionally caused lots of home fires. Curious kids, pets, knocking them over and then creating fires from the heat within the bulbs. People, pine-scented things, and all the nice different candles you have that smell great are also, it's an open source of flame. And so keeping those away from curtains, keeping them away from children, keeping them away from your trees, it's just mitigating the chances that you may experience a house fire.
And if it's a natural tree, I've heard that keeping it regularly watered is
absolutely
a good thing too, right?
Right.
Okay. If somebody wants more information on all of this, you gave us your number. Do you have a website as well?
We do. Redcross.org/Alaska. And that pertains specifically to our region here in the entire state. We have disaster specialists that cover every community in Alaska.
Another question. This time of year, a lot of folks are doing a lot of cooking, a lot of potlucks. What are some things to think about in that respect?
We see a lot of house fires with deep frying turkeys, and making sure you're doing that a safe distance away from your house. Make sure you're present in the kitchen while things are going on, not getting distracted. Make sure you're wearing appropriate clothing. Loose fitting things can get caught and pulled things over. It's really just being observant and, you know, being smart and being safe.
Okay. Andrew, give us the contact info once more if somebody wants to get a hold of you.
So you can reach my office at 907-463-5713, and then you can find us online at redcross.org/Alaska, or slash Alaska, I apologize. And you can actually find my office, which is at 3225 Hospital Drive, Suite 202, just down the hill from the hospital.
All right. Andrew Bogar, he's the Disaster Program Specialist here in Juneau with the Alaska Red Cross. Anything else you want to add?
We're always looking for volunteers. If someone would like to take some time out of their day, it doesn't take much. Everything from an hour a month to an hour a week. We're trying to grow the program down here. I'm really excited about being here and getting a larger, more active presence in the Southeast is really important.
On that note, what are you looking for in a volunteer?
We have so many different roles that need filling. There isn't a traditional volunteer. If we'll take anybody, because we need people to answer phones. We need people who are willing to make phone calls. We need people who are comfortable in doing roles like this and talking on the air and managing social media. We have many small communities just here in Juneau between Douglas and North Douglas and out the road. And I would like each of these communities to be represented within our organization.
Okay. Andrew Bogart, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm walking home now. The streets are glowing neath the pale moonlight. I look around, there's not a soul in sight. I am walking home. Once again I hear my mother's voice. Dollar's kid making a bunch of noise. If I'm not careful, I might start to cry. Walking home tonight. I turn my head and hear the screen door slam. And there he is, that tall, dark-haired man. He looks my way, but all alone. I am walking home. He's my dad, you know. I was his girl. He taught me all he knew about this world. And then he traveled right on. Walking home tonight. I'm walking home tonight. The streets are glowing in the pale moonlight. I look around, there's not a soul in sight. Walking home.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Arena is now open for the 2015-2016 season with a 5-day schedule. More information at juno.org/parkrec/icerink or call 586-4540.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 16th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 15 minutes until the top of the hour. Joining me now in the studio is Crystal Randolph. She is the UAS Tidal Echoes Fall Intern. Welcome to the show, Crystal.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, so Tidal Echoes, the UAS Literary Journal, a very cool journal. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, of course. Tidal Echoes is actually Southeast Alaska's literary and arts journal. So it's produced here in Juneau by a team of students and faculty at UAS. And every year it's put together, and basically we get submissions of poetry, artwork, and prose from all over the region, from places like Sitka, Ketchikan, Metlakatla. All sorts of communities will submit their artwork and poetry and prose to us, and we'll put it together in the journal during the spring semester, and we publish it then.
And this is for all residents of Southeast Alaska?
Yeah, everyone in Southeast Alaska. If you're a full-time resident, you are eligible to submit your work.
And does it cost money to submit?
Not at all. It's completely free.
Okay. When is your deadline for this year?
Our deadline is December 1st this year, and so it's December 1st at midnight.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you said all kinds of art.
All kinds of artwork. So we are all about featuring the talented work of our artists and writers here in Southeast Alaska. That's what we want to make the journal about, is showcasing that work. And so anybody who wants to submit, like whether it's photography, painting, sculpture, or carving, or, for example, lots of people submit masks and things like that, too. And so any of that kind of work is eligible. So if you just send a photograph of that work in to us, then that can get in the journal.
Excellent. And you have last year's in your lap right there, right?
Yeah, I do. Tidal Echoes, last year, it's the 2015 edition. So we have Fumi Matsumoto's work featured on the cover. It's a very beautiful book.
And do you have an example of work you want to share with us from that?
Definitely. I have a piece by Joe Lewis, who's a UAS student right now. And it's a poem that he wrote for last year's journal called Whiskey in Autumn. Snow dusts the peaks of Mount McGinnis, clinging to the branches like bald eagles. Born on the first snowfall in November, so her mama called her Autumn. Her heated fingertips rake down my chilled back. They bite. Cedar smoke and ash swirl in my nose the way scotch massages my tongue. Whiskey and Autumn keep my body warm beside the light of a faint beach fire. Her hair in my face lit up by the cinders, casting shadows on tent walls and spruce tips. Our bodies exposed to smoke and moonlight, making love while the sun sleeps.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Who's that by again?
That's by Joe Lewis. He's a student here at UAS.
All right. What do you get the most of, and what would you say the journal's in need of the most?
Well, I think that we get a lot of writing. Tends to be a lot of poetry and prose. But we also get a lot of photography. So I would really love to see more traditional works here from Southeast Alaska, like carving and weaving. It would be really wonderful. This year, our featured artist is actually a weaver from Sitka, Terry Rothkar. And so we're really excited to have her working with the journal. She's doing some really awesome work with weaving in the traditional Tlingit style.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So you were saying if somebody does something physical like sculpture, they send you a picture, of course, but there are other submission sort of guidelines. Tell us about those.
Yeah, of course. So as far as the submission guidelines go, a big thing to note is that this year we're going through the submittable program, which is an online submission form. And so that changes because the way we used to do it is we used to take submissions over email. But now it's really been streamlined, so you don't have to worry about sending in a release form and separate emails for your piece. You can just log on to Submittable, and the way that works is you would go to our account at universityofalaskasoutheast.submittable.com/submit, and then when you get to that page, you'll see that there are three categories. There's poetry, prose, and artwork. And so from there, you would select which of the three categories you're submitting to. And if you don't already have a Submittable account, it'll ask that you sign up for one. But don't worry, because that's entirely free, and it's just so that you can keep track of your submissions in case you submit to other journals and magazines, because a lot of them are using Submittable these days. And so after you've created that account, you will be required to provide a last name, first name, a physical address, a phone number, an email address, and then a short writer and artist's biography. And if you're a current UAS student, we ask that you also provide your student ID number. After that, you would fill out a creative piece. So you would upload either your poetry or prose, or you would upload your art file. And so for poetry and prose, we only accept document files that are programmed in Microsoft Word. And for artwork, we accept TIFF and JPEG files. And the artwork needs to be at least 1,800 pixels wide. So.
Okay. If somebody had a question before they went through the submission process, would it be appropriate for them to contact you and run them by you?
Yeah, of course. If they have any further questions, they can call Emily Wall, who's the faculty advisor for the journal, and that phone number is 907-796-6113, or they can send an email to us at titleechoes@uas.alaska.edu.
And I suspect if anyone just put in UAS Title Echoes in the search engine, they'd find you right away and links to all of this.
Yeah.
Crystal, what's the atmosphere like working with Emily? Where do you all put the journal together? I've always been curious about that.
Well, we tend to all work together in Emily's office most of the time. So we'll meet there. We'll meet at Spike's Cafe up at UAS. And so it's really a very community family feel. Like, we all get together and we'll talk about what's going on with the journal and we'll plan what needs to happen next. And it's just really supportive. It's a great atmosphere. And I highly recommend getting involved with the journal if anyone's a student listening right now and looking for an internship. It's a great one to be involved with.
Yeah, and because you're about to graduate, right?
Yeah, right.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's see. I wonder if we're missing anything. Is there anything else that you'd like to add, Crystal?
If I could, I just wanted to mention that the terms of agreement box on our submission form is really important. It's something that you have to check before you can submit. And without a release form, we won't have the rights to publish your work in our journal. So it's highly important that you remember to put that little thing in there.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. So December 1st is our submission deadline, and in the spring we'll be having a launch party for the journal, and that will be on April 15th at 7 o'clock. And we're planning to host it in the Egan Lecture Hall, as we usually do, but the location is also to be announced. So it could be there, and it might be someplace else depending on the university.
Okay. Crystal Randolph, she's working with UAS's Title Echoes. The deadline is December 1st. Is that right?
December 1st is correct.
Okay. Crystal, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 16th, 2015. It's about 6 minutes until the top of the hour.
This is Bird Note. At this time of year, Bosque del Apache National Wildlife Refuge in south-central New Mexico is a birder's paradise. Many rise early to witness the magnificent spectacle of the sunrise flyout of some 14,000 sandhill cranes. And more than 30,000 Ross's geese and snow geese. The sunset fly-in is equally impressive. Bosque del Apache translates from Spanish as the Woods of the Apache. The refuge sits where the northern edge of the Chihuahuan Desert, called High Desert here because it's above 4,000 feet, meets the Rio Grande River. The heart of the refuge now supports 20 square miles of moist bottomlands, including wetlands and riverside forest, critical wintering habitat for great numbers of birds. The cranes here return each November from nesting grounds in the northern Rockies and Dakotas, just in time for the annual Festival of the Cranes. Over 6 days, the refuge offers field trips, lectures, workshops, and hikes as a way of celebrating this remarkable oasis in New Mexico's high desert. There are more than 500 national wildlife refuges for you to visit and enjoy. To learn which one is nearest you, begin at birdnote.org.
Support comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, offering HydroFit every Tuesday and Thursday from 6:30 p.m. until 7:30, Aqua Aerobics Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. until noon, and Stretch Aquatics Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45. Fall swim schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/rec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
Thanks for tuning into A Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with Sandy Fiscus about the Juno FASD Clinic. We'll get a preview of Scott Carley's Tuesday night Juno World Affairs Council presentation about Costa Rica. We'll highlight partnerships for families and children with guest Nikki Love. Rena Simmons will be here to highlight this year's St. Vincent de Paul Thanksgiving baskets. We'll learn about salt cave therapy with guest Charboom. FDMS principal, Floyd Dryden Middle School principal Jim Thompson will be here to talk about the upcoming event, Dads and Donuts. Those interviews, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more live at 3 on KTOO News, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and online via KTOO.org. Take a look at the weather. Currently 34 degrees at the Juneau Airport. The forecast calls for tonight mostly cloudy, scattered rain showers early in the evening, then scattered snow showers, lows around 28, light winds. Tuesday, mostly cloudy, scattered snow showers, highs around 32, light winds becoming east 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. Wednesday, snow showers likely, highs around 30. Thursday, mostly cloudy, chance of snow, highs around 32, and Thursday night and Friday, rain and snow likely, lows around 31, and then it calls for rain on Saturday, highs around 40. Thanks for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon. Tune in same time, same frequency tomorrow.